So, meditation. Where, is it all recording okay? No? Yes. So, for our meditation, so far I've talked quite a bit about the best meditation, preparing your mindfulness, and especially in the present moment. But there's also some other little teachings which we can use. And sometimes it's a preparation. And that preparation, there's many other little ways. And it was some years ago when I was visiting Singapore, and it was close to the Waisak season. So I got invited to go for the morning to teach at Little Gems. And I thought, it was like kids. I didn't realize how small those kids were. I mean, they were kindergarten and pre-kindergarten. Oh my goodness me, how am I going to teach Dhamma to preschool kids? But you know, sometimes I'm a courageous monk, I do silly things sometimes, but I always manage to learn from the difficulties of life. Recall even going to a primary school here in Perth, in Roldystone. The teacher, it was so many years ago, the teacher there started introducing meditation in her classes. This must have been about 30 years ago. And it was quite a posh area and many Christians. And when she started introducing meditation to her class of grade 6, many of the parents, when they found out, they complained to the principal. But apparently the principals had noticed that the children in that class, their academic achievement was increasing, and also that their social sensitivities were also increasing. And so he invited me to the school, and I thought I was going to teach that class. But before I taught that class, he just brought me in to have a cup of tea. He said he was a devout Christian himself. But he said that he's seen that what this lady, Kerry, was calling quiet time. It was meditation. And quiet time was when the beginning of the day, they'd all sit down and they'd just relax and just be aware of their breath. And they started the year 5 minutes, which was quite a lot. But then during the school year, 3 terms, they increased it to maybe 20 minutes every morning. And she said the amazing thing was that sometimes in a class, of boys and girls, six, that'd be 12 years of age, or 11, 12 years of age, that sometimes there'd be a bit of aggression, sometimes there'd be, some bad speech. And she said she didn't need to actually to stop this bad speech or this little aggression. As soon as people in the class realized there was no peace and harmony, one kid, not always a girl, a boy, whoever, would put up their hand, "Miss, can we have quiet time now?" And all the children in the class would actually sit down, close their eyes, and do some meditation for 5-10 minutes. And she said that solved so many problems in the class. And that was an unexpected benefit. They were using that as a circuit breaker for ill will, craving. At that time, kids were starting into puberty. So that was a very difficult time for them, and it was a great solution. And so that's why he said, "I'm a Christian, I know this is Buddhist, but I don't care, it works, and I will defend that teacher, with my job." And he did, and good on him. But anyway, when I went to the class, it wasn't the class of grade sixes they got me to teach. It was a grade one and grade twos. A whole heap of them, about maybe 100 of them, about 3 or 4 classes. And I was totally unprepared, and I thought, how do you teach watching the breath to a group of, of 5-year-olds? How do you teach anything? And the parents were there as well. They were watching, just checking me out. And of course, you know, sometimes I just get it right. The times when I get it wrong, I never repeat to you in my talks. Only the times when something good happens. So, I thought, okay. So I started off, I said, how many of you, just a kiss, how many of you like rice pudding? And what? Rice pudding. And about three or four, oh no, sorry, it wasn't, do you like, how many of you don't like rice pudding, was the question. How many don't like rice pudding? It's like a sweet made of rice, milk and sugar. How many of you don't like rice pudding? And about three or four kids put their hands up. Only three amongst about a class of, four classes of about 100. And then you see all the other kids looking around. And then, so they saw, you know, three or four kids put their hand up, so they put their hand up as well. And then another kid put their hand up. And after about 1 minute, they'd all decided, 100 people, they did not like rice pudding. Okay, hands down. Now, how many of you have ever eaten rice pudding? About two kids, well, no, five kids put their hand up. And all the other kids laughed. They understood conditioning, peer pressure, believing what other people tell you. Because only a few kids have ever eaten rice pudding. But when three or four said, no, they don't like it, that was it. The whole class don't like it. And so I was actually quite pleased that there you taught the Dhamma of conditioning and belief. In other words, not checking out for yourself, not come and see and to be experienced every wise person for themselves, but just the following what other people do without ever eating rice pudding. Just like the other day when I talked about boiled frog on rice. A few people, you could see their faces all screw up. Yeah. So, how many of you don't like boiled frog on rice? And that would be followed by the question, how many of you have ever eaten boiled frog on rice? And I'm the only one here, I would imagine. So you can actually see just how our likes and dislikes are totally conditioned. And how meditation is hard. Is it? Depends on how you meditate. So sometimes people believe that, and they make it hard. Sometimes people think, you have to do it this way. You have to get jhanas. You have to do this, you have to do that. For goodness sake, find out for yourself. Even for sort of jhanas, so few people really know what they're like. So, why do you want them? Are you sure, when you get jhanas, that you'll be satisfied with them? This was like when I was a young man. Interested in... Actually, I'm still a young man, aren't I? Well, sort of. That's all relative. So, when I was a student, the school, through scholarships, went to a good school in West London, and there was good enough to have a chaplain. I remember going to see the chaplain one day and asking the chaplain, said, God, what is God? Now, I was interested in spirituality, but no one had ever actually explained it to me in words I could understand. Now, what is it? And then, now, he was obviously very happy that a young man was interested in spirituality, so he took a bit of time out and started to explain it to me, that, you know, the Christian idea of God is beyond words. It's ineffable. It's, you know, you can't describe it. It's the beginning and end of all things. It's the ground of all being. It's the Alpha and Omega, which means the A to Z. And I thought, I mean, God is a street directory? And I said, but what actually is it? They said, it's beyond words, it's beyond comprehension. You know, that was not satisfying at all. I thought, the fellow doesn't know what he's talking about. Because if you know what you're talking about, you should be able to describe it. You should be able to convey your understanding to somebody else, even to a young 16-year-old, so that they can really understand what you're talking about. And later on, when I did go to college, it was one of Werner Heisenberg's sayings. He said, if you know what you're talking about with quantum physics, which is one of the most abstruse, complicated parts of our modern philosophy, if you know what you're talking about, you'll be able to explain it clearly to the barmaid serving you a pint of beer in the pub. And she'll understand. Your measure of knowledge of your subject is you can convey that in simple words to the listener. And so, when I heard that, I thought, these people don't know what they're talking about. But they just won't admit it. And then, of course, you go and become a Buddhist. And then you go and see all these learned monks in London, and I ask them the same question. What is Nibbana? Ineffable, beginning beyond words, the ground of all being. I said, I've heard that before. You also don't know what you're talking about. So sometimes, if you know what you're talking about, then you can explain things clearly and they understand. And it was such a relief to go and see an Ajahn Chah, who, obviously, he was teaching in Thai and Lao, but soon you learn that language. And when he gave the teachings and you asked him what is enlightenment, you soon found out. He just said it very, very clearly. And even though this is not one of Ajahn Chah's teachings, it was still by far the best description of what enlightenment is. I mention it now because I did actually promise to tell about the different types of freedom. So, this was that story of the five children playing wishing game. It's one of my favorite stories. Because it starts off in just secular, worldly stuff, and it just takes you stage by stage, step by step, out of some wonderful understanding of what Nibbana is, why we meditate, why meditation is the path into Nibbana, and how it all fits together. So, five children playing wishing game goes like this. Every child has a wish. And the child who comes up with the best superior wish will win the wishing game. So the first child said, if you had a wish, what would it be? And the first child said, if I had a wish, I would wish for, you have to help me on this one, for a new Pokemon or Xbox or, what's the video games, which is very popular? Anyone know?
Delta.
Video game. Yeah, well, because there was one night, I asked the monks, can you tell me about video games? And some of them, young ones, they grew up with video games, and they started talking. And it was like they were talking, like me talking in Pali to you. I couldn't understand a word of what they were saying. It was totally gobbledygook. But he wanted the latest video game console or video game, whatever it was. Very good. And there was the next kid. What would you like? And it's always helpful in these sorts of competitions never to be the first. Because when you've already got a couple of people already had their wish, you've got time to think of something, and also you've got a time to improve and do better than the ones before you. So the second one said, yeah, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a video game shop. So I can get the latest video game whenever I want, because I own the shop. I don't just get one video game, I can upgrade all the time. And the third person thought and said, "Now, the trouble with video games is my parents will never let me play my video games until I've done all my homework. So, what I will do, I will have $1 billion US, and I'll buy my own video game shop, and there's plenty of money left over. The next thing, I'll buy my own school." Now, if I own the school, then I can just even not go to school, not give homework. How can the teachers punish me for not doing my homework when I own the school? If they do the wrong thing, I'll punish them, I'll sack them. And that way, because if I only own my own school, I can just spend all my time playing video games and still give myself top marks. I own the school, I employ the headmaster. And when I graduate from my own school, then I can buy my own university, like Mr. Trump, give myself... And my parents were very happy. There's my son, doctor, and I've never done a job a day of work in the university at all. And I spent all my time playing video games. And then with $1 billion US, I always have some money to spend on something else, sometime else. Very smart. You see, if you wait, not be the first, you can always do better. Just like that story here in Australia of the three religious leaders. There was Christian, the bishop, the rabbi, and the monk, Buddhist monk. And they decided that, you know, to try and get some religious harmony. And so they would have discussions, but they're too formal. So then they said, well, let's come down for, say, like afternoon tea or something, so we can actually just relax a bit more and just get some bonding going. But they were getting so far, and then one of the religious leaders said, well, look, we need to actually just bond even further. We need some sort of competition, working together, whatever. And so they decided to start playing cards. Now, and then they decided, let's try poker. So, you know, just trying to get some... Because we have all these interfaith meetings, and my goodness, they're so boring. All trying to please one another. So let's have a bit of competition and see how we relate. You know, when this one wins and that one wins, see, you know, how our religious theologies can work together in times of stress and competitiveness like the real world. So they started playing cards, poker. But unfortunately, that was illegal in that country. And the police found out and arrested all three of them. So they had to appear in front of the magistrate, accused of gambling. And so the magistrate, the first one in the box was the pastor, and said, "Reverend, you know, you are a member of the church, so I'm not going to mince words with you. Were you gambling?" And faster than the eye can see, he looked up in the heavens and said, "Jesus, forgive me," and said, "No." It's so fast, not even the magistrate could see him. Jesus. No. So then, okay, off you go. Then the rabbi's turn. And the rabbi came into the box. "Rabbi, were you gambling?" And what he did the old trick I remember doing at school. If you cross your fingers behind your back... And he tried that. He said, "No." Okay, off you go. And then it was the Buddhist monks. I think the judge must have suspected something. He said, "Put your hands in front. You know you don't believe in Jesus, so putting your head up there and asking forgiveness doesn't work for you. Venerable, were you gambling?" And the monks replied, "With whom, Your Majesty?" "With whom?" <laughs> That's why it always pays to be the last. Anyway, now we go back to the fourth kid. Three kids. The third kid, $1 billion US, had one wish. How can you get a better wish than that? I know somebody said $2 billion. No, that's the same as $1 billion. And he was very smart. He said, if I had a wish, I would have three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'd have $1 billion US. The second wish, I will have my own computer game shop. And for my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Infinity of wishes granted. How can you get better than that? And the fifth child, if you haven't heard this story before, it's nice to pause and ask people what they would do to try and beat that wish. An infinity of wishes granted to you. That fifth child clearly beat all the other children and won the wishing game. The fifth child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed a wish ever again. So content I never needed any more wishes. And that is the best explanation I've ever heard of enlightenment. The freedom from desire. You don't need anything. You don't wish for anything. You're happy, whatever happens. So content, you don't need any more wishes. The end of desire, the end of ill will, the end of delusion. And one of the reasons I like that was because you can see the happiness, what people aspire to, just a little bit before that. Infinity of wishes granted. Power. And before that, the third child, wealth. And you can actually see that with people in the world. You've got wealthy people. You know, people like Donald Trump. First of all, it took a long time to understand why wealthy people would want to be presidents of the United States or prime ministers. You've got so much money anyway. Well, what do you want all that problem, all that stress for? And all that criticism? Who in their right mind would want to, no, don't go there, I know what you're thinking. No one in their right mind would want to be. But anyway, so there we have people with wealth, but that's not enough, because all their wishes will never be granted with wealth, but power. So the third child, wealth. The fourth child, may I have an infinity of wishes granted. You only get that when you have power and immense power. But better than all of that, better than wealth, better than power, is being so content you don't need any wishes ever again. Peace at last. That's enlightenment. The end of desire, the end of craving. And you can't get to the end of desire, the end of craving, real deep peace, by wanting to be peaceful. If you want to be peaceful, you're just making more of the same. But if instead of wanting to be peaceful, you make peace. You make peace in every moment. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Who said that? I read that somewhere on somebody's back on a t-shirt. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. We make peace. This retreat center, I designed and built a lot of this. So, how do you build this? It's a huge project. One brick at a time. And after a few years, you have this beautiful meditation hall. One, making peace at a time. One moment of peace you make. When you made this moment peaceful, you made the next moment peaceful. Then you make the next moment peaceful. One brick of peace at a time. And before you know it, you have your house of peace in which you can live comfortably and calmly. We make peace. One of that poems, which was in the beginning of my first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. Grant yourself a moment of peace, and you'll realize how foolishly you've scurried about. Grant yourself the moment of peace. You have to give it to yourself. You have to say, no, I deserve this moment of peace. Yeah, there's many things to do, but I'll do them later. Peace is important. You give yourself the chance to be peaceful. Otherwise, wait for peace to come to you. So I'll make peace later on. It never happens. You grant yourself that moment of peace. But what happens when you've got so much unfinished business? I think you're all old enough now to realize you've been to many funerals of your relations and colleagues. Is your business ever gotten out of the way? Have you ever finished? Have you ever tied up the loose ends? No one ever does. There's always another loose end to tie up. So sometimes, how can we find some peace? It gets to the point these days for modern humanity. There's only one place you ever find ordinary people resting in peace. It's a bit late then, isn't it? You're in a cemetery, dead in your box. So, if you really want to find peace before you die, you have to think outside the box. That's what I had to copy. Let's see if you can find peace now. So how can you find peace? You're never going to tie up all of those ends. So there was that marvellous, great little teaching of Ajahn Buddhadasa. And many of you know these teachings, but it's great to reinforce them, repeat them. And that means that eventually that it really sinks in, and even though you've heard it before, even my monks have heard these teachings so many times. They say, no, please say them again, because I always get something deeper from them every time. And that was the teaching of, he was building his hall, Ajahn Buddhadasa, his main meditation hall. And it comes to the rains retreat. Rains retreat is a time when the monks, they stop all their building and their travelling and they stay put, right? Venerable Chanda coming here to for 3 months, so she doesn't have to do anything for that Anukampa stuff. Unfortunately, that's waiting for you when you get back. That waits for me when I come out of my retreat. But what this monk did, he sent all the builders home the first day of the rains retreat. And the next day or two, the visitor came. And said, like what many visitors say, when is your project going to be finished? When is your hall going to be complete? And without any hesitation, Ajahn Buddhadasa, it is finished. What do you mean, it's finished? Said the visitor. There's no roof on the building. There's no glass in the windows. There's no doors. There is cement bags all over the floor. Are you going to leave it like this? Isn't it something like Zen Koan? Just, you know, the unfinished hall which will never be finished. What are you talking about that your hall is finished? And at that, Ajahn Buddhadasa repeated the memorable words, Sir, what's done is finished. What's done is finished. And my goodness, that has saved me so much stress in my work and in your life. So, when you go back to Singapore and your boss asks, have you finished that contract with preparation? Say, boss, what's done is finished. Okay. Well, anyway, you get the sack, you come here and become a real muckle and nun. We always give you a place here. So anyway, but it meant you gave yourself a break, gave yourself some time, gave yourself some freedom. What was most important in life? So you can be free. You make peace. You give yourself moments of peace. And that's what you do in meditation. Sometimes your meditation can be just more work, finishing off some task, reaching the goal. When I get jhana, then I'll be finished. There's many jhanas. So if you're on this retreat, you get first jhana. Yeah, I got first jhana. Now what? Second jhana. Okay. Work hard again. Meditate. Get a sore bum. Get second jhana. Yay! Now what? Third jhana. How many of these have I got to do? then you got enlightenment. First stage. Second stage of enlightenment. Come on. Get going. Is that like more school, more achievements, more stuff to do? It's so stressful if you think like that. But it's because people don't know what enlightenment is and what the deep meditations are. They are being so content. You don't need any more meditation achievements. You don't want anything. You're peaceful, you're content. Then you find the jhanas come to you. It's just a deepening of contentment, the solidifying of peace, getting calmer and calmer and calmer. That's just how the body and mind work. That's why one of the most important ingredients is being so content, you don't want anything. Happy to be here. So, the jhanas, they are just landmarks on the journey. The stages of enlightenment, they are just stages of you disappearing, disentangling from the world, becoming more and more free from the world. It's not having more and more burdens, more and more things you have to prove. In fact, I remember this very wise words of advice, which actually came from a Zen bhikshuni from Korea, Jogje Order. It was Chi Kwang's teacher, apparently. And she told her, if you ever get enlightened, don't tell anybody. Otherwise, you'll have to spend the rest of your life trying to prove it. It's very wise words of advice. People look at you and say, you, enlightened? Yeah. Or they do tests on you. At lunchtime, when you have your favourite food, they mix it up with a bowl. In the jhanas, the doctor will do an incision on you to see if it hurts. So it is. But there was one monastery. It was a few years ago. I was told a story by, I think none of you were in Berkeley during that last global conference. It was this really nice Sri Lankan man called Lau. Really looking after us. And anyway, have you met him when you've gone to Berkeley? He looks after everybody, very generous, and especially to the bhikshunis. Anyway, he told me some of these nice little stories that in Colombo, the capital of Sri Lanka, there was a family doing pretty well. And they invited their grandma up from the villages up country to come and visit Colombo. And she came down, but she wasn't interested in touring around or watching, seeing movies or whatever. She was a devout Buddhist. So what can we do with our grandma to keep her happy? She was so nice to us. And they'd heard there was a meditation retreat center. Someone's heard this story before. They know what's coming. The meditation retreat center. That's a nice place to send grandma for a couple of months. And it was a meditation retreat center, a special one. For 2 months, you would study suttas, that you would listen to lectures, you would meditate, and they had a staff of experts there. And at the end of the course of 2 months, they would give you an exam, a test. And on basis of that test and your meditation experiences, they would give some lucky ones certificates. Certificates to attest that yes, you have got first jhana, you have got second jhana, but in particular, enlightenment certificates. They would give you a certificate that you had achieved the first stage of enlightenment, you are Sotapanna, or the second stage, or the third stage, or very, very rarely, the fourth stage. Full enlightenment. And so, this grandma went to the retreat 2 months. And after 2 months, they had like the graduation ceremony, the last meeting, where the board of directors of this institute would call people up, say, Claire, you have... So they called up this grandma. Grandma, come up. We're very joyful. We've seen your progress. We've checked your understanding of the Dhamma. And we're so proud to award you that we've decided that no doubt at all, you are a stream winner. Here, we present you with a certificate proving you are a stream winner. Congratulations. So they actually certified her as a stream winner. The problem was, as soon as they handed over the certificate, she started to get upset. Why are you upset? Even says in the suttas, the achievement of stream winning is one of the most joyful, highest experiences in the world, better than becoming the president of the United States, world-turning monarch or whatever. And she was really upset. So why are you upset at us? And she looked at them with the steely dagger eyes only elderly women can actually look at you with. I think that's pretty true. You know, as a guy anyway, sometimes I look at you and you get really scared. It was like what they used to say, what was that, I think, Chirac said of Margaret Thatcher? What was it? The lips of Monroe and the eyes of Caligula. The French are beautiful on that. They just really know how to put things into good words. Caligula was a very dangerous man. But anyway, so, and he said, you don't remember me, do you? No, who are you? I was here about 6 years ago. And you gave me the non-returner certificate. You've demoted me. So that was the end of that group. They soon disbanded when that news got around. So these aren't attainments. It's just how you just start disappearing. So, when you understand that, sometimes you can understand that the path of meditation is a path of lessening desire, not wanting more. Being more and more happy to be here. And from that, just, I come back to where I started this talk, with some preschool children teaching them meditation. You can't say, watch the breath. You can't go through the Satipatthana Sutta with them. but it was Waisak Day. So I decided to not kill two birds with one stone, that's not Buddhist, but do the cut two carrots with the same knife. By which I said, on Waisak Day, what happened? The Buddha was born. He took seven steps and put up a finger that this is my last life. I am the chief in the world. So, okay, kids. Seven steps, please. And after the end of seven steps, put your finger up. Not that one. I don't know what kids in Singapore see. I am the best. And see, but they acted it out. Because play acting is actually when you almost start to relive that part. And having the birth of the Buddha, the next thing, the Buddha's enlightenment. This is on Waisak Day. The first teaching was given on the first day of the rains retreat full moon day of July. But the enlightenment, and I had a big picture of the Buddha there, like sitting meditation. So, pretend you're the Buddha. Sit down on the floor and put your right hand over your left hand, thumbs touching, back straight, chin down, eyes closed. And I imagine you're the Buddha. Can we join in with me this? Because this is really cool. You can definitely just change your posture. Your eyes closed. You're under the Bodhi tree. It's cool. It's quiet. You can hear a few birds in the park of Uruwela, as Budgaya was called before. Maybe you can imagine the river Nirmala flowing calmly close by. A little wind. You're sitting under the Bodhi tree, the very first Bodhi tree. You're enlightened. There's nothing more to be done. Nothing more to be strived for. Everything is finished. Your work has been done. You know you have no fear for the future. No anxiety left. You have the highest safety, the highest peace. All striving has ended. You're the Buddha. Imagine how that feels. You don't have any worries, any fears. The future is gone. You're here in this moment, just under a tree. You relax because there's nothing to be done. All jobs are finished. The past, it's so easy to let go. There's no grief, there's no anger. There's no revenge or resentment. You're a Buddha. Just sitting here, relaxing, just being. As you just watch your breath go in and go out. Not to try and achieve anything, because all those achievements have been completed. There's nothing to strive for anymore. Nothing missing. Everything is complete. Sitting there, a Buddha, on the first Waisak Day. No one bothering you. They don't know who you are. You've disappeared. Perfect peace. You don't need to make peace anymore. You are peace. Peace, sitting under the Bodhi tree. relaxed, at ease, free. If somebody asks you, do you need any wishes? You're so content. You don't need any wishes ever again. You're at peace. Free. Can you imagine that this is like Bodh Gaya? Cool. Comfortable. Silent. When you're ready, you can open your eyes. And all the kids in the little gems, just like you, are so quiet. Give them words, and they don't understand. Give them feelings, a picture, a role to play, imagination. That does work. It's using... That was that good? I didn't want to come out either, but I got interviews, so... But it was all the teachers. They were getting into it as well. And then, of course, the last one was being the Buddha at Kusinara. So lying on your right side, I got to do all the posture, had a statue there. All the kids were doing that. Now close your eyes. This is your parinibbana, the final passing away. And all the kids were like, they were getting into it by now. And then, of course, the time came, I said, okay. And they teased it. No, no. Because the kids were so peaceful. And they were, maybe some of them were asleep, I don't know, but they're certainly enjoying it. And they were so calm, imagining they were the Buddha. And what a wonderful way to teach when the teachers actually get some peace and quiet. And and they can justify, yeah, that's Buddhism, actually teaching what happened on Waysack and actually doing it and enjoying it. And so I think afterwards that I think I did some talk somewhere, and I think even the members of the Buddhist Fellowship or Bunyan Singapore, I forget who it was, that they said, can we do that please again? Yeah, sometimes that... Who was it? Somebody told me, he said, I know your success as a teacher, Ajahn Brahm. You teach us like we were kids. And I thought, actually, there's a lot of truth to that. Don't use big words. Don't try and philosophize. To teach you at a level we can all understand with some fun and games. To innovate. And to learn just how to imagine. So, in the beginning of your next meditation, whenever that is, experiment with that. Imagine when you sit down on a chair. The Buddha sat on chairs. In other words, people would always say, nah, sitting on a chair, that's for weaklings. People aren't really into meditation. If you're really into meditation, if you're really going for enlightenment, if you really want to get some deep meditation, you have to sit on the floor. You have to sit on the floor. And you have to sit for hours. Doesn't matter how much pain you've got. Sit through the pain. One of my friends, a monk, decided to sit through pain. All night he sat. Didn't move. Following day, we took him to hospital. Honestly. Had to have double knee reconstruction. Another monk, one of the first monks in England, he decided... He read in the books that even in the cold weather, cold, it's all just a matter of the mind. And even the Buddha sat in the cold outside just with his three robes on. So this monk, he went to Hampstead Heath in January sometimes, at night time, just in his three robes. No beanie, no socks, no shawl, just three robes. To show just how strong his mind was. Following day, he went to hospital with pneumonia. Some of the monks are crazy. Once there was a monk. Well, actually, it wasn't a monk, an aspiring monk. He was on Waisak in his university town somewhere. And he was so inspired after learning that the Buddha made his determination. May my blood dry up and my bones turn to dust, and I will not move from this spot until I achieve full enlightenment. That young man, which you know who, sitting in front of you. And I said, right, if the Buddha can do this, then I can too. I'm educated. I go to Cambridge. I'm English. I am arrogant. I never said that, but that's what the truth of that was. So, after the Waisak day, which we held there, that would be 1970, and 20 minutes was my max of sitting meditation. On the restlessness or aches and pains. But no, this was it. If the Buddha could do this, I could too. So I sat down and I made that resolution. Really seriously. No messing around. Even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I am not going to move from this seat until I achieve full enlightenment. And I sat down there. By half an hour, I was in absolute agony. But I still pushed through. I made it to about 35 minutes. That's all I could take. And out of my eyes. And I was so disappointed. Three reasons I was disappointed. One, my blood was still liquid. My bones were still solid and turned to dust, and I certainly was not enlightened. I actually did that. So stupid. So, but instead of actually using the force, use the imagination. What must it like to be enlightened? And then you get much closer. If you were feeling peaceful, free, you had a taste of freedom. Just using your imagination. The taste of freedom from wanting anything. You imagined you were the Buddha. Role played. And there you were, feeling the taste of freedom. Now you get an understanding of what this is all about. What it's like. And sometimes you can start your meditation that way if you wish, imagining that you are enlightened. And then just from there, it's like you've got a quick boost along the path. And even if there's this one gentleman, he's just, interestingly, the same gentleman I mentioned who saw his mother at the end of his bed when his mother died in England and he was here in Perth. Same gentleman. He said he always had a lot of difficulty watching his breath. Just couldn't do it. And then one day, his teacher, it wasn't me, I don't know who this teacher was, but whoever it was, Sadhu Sadhu, great teacher. The teacher said, well look, forget about trying to watch the breath. Imagine you're watching the breath, just imagine it. Okay, close your eyes, imagine watching the breath. I know you can't watch the breath because you tried that so many times, I've given you all sorts of tricks. Just imagine you're watching the breath. Imagine what it's like to be watching the breath go in, go out, 3 or 4 or 5 times in a row. And so this gentleman was doing this and just imagining he was watching the breath. Not watching the breath, just imagining he was doing it. And then the teacher interrupted him. What are you watching? The breath, he replied. What that imagination was just bypassing this psychological block. I can't watch the breath. Every time I do it, I wander off. Imagine you're doing it. Using that power of the mind, imagination. And it's pretty easy to make that switch from the imagination to reality. They're so close. So those of you who haven't seen a nimitta yet, when you get sort of peaceful, Imagine you're watching an emitter. You've heard me talk about them many times. Sit down. You're peaceful. Not at the beginning of the meditation, because it won't be stable enough. You get a certain type of depth of meditation, pretty peaceful. Then imagine you're watching an emitter. Imagine. Don't worry if it's not real. Just imagine. And then see what happens. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Hee hee hee. Okay.